Committee will come to order. A quorum is present. The clerk will note the roll. Representative Broad moves approval of the minutes of the 46th meeting of the Tax Committee, which occurred on Thursday, March 4th, 2004. As many as are in favor of that motion, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, say no. Motion prevails. The first item that we're going to discuss today, members, and have presented is the single-factor sale issue. There are currently five bills, including one yesterday introduced by Representative Ruth, that is for the committee. Sticking with my precedent, we will take the lowest number bill and have that be used as the vehicle. So Representative Lencheski moves that House File 2432 be recommended to pass and considered for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. I think before we go to the testifiers, there's some material to be passed out, and I'm going to recognize Joel Michael for an overview for those members who need some review on the issue. But welcome to the committee, Representative Lencheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Michael.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, just to, there are a number of materials that have been handed out. There's a couple of publications from our office that are on beige or buff colored paper that provide some background on, first of all, the apportionment of the corporate franchise tax, how the apportionment formula works mechanically, and the various different rules that are involved with that. I'm not going to go through that because I know there are folks that want to testify, and in general you want to talk about the issue of increasing the sales weighting of the apportionment formula. There's a separate publication that's entitled Single Sales Apportionment of the Corporate Franchise that just discusses the issue about of the sales, more heavily weighting the sales factor, and goes through some of the arguments for and some of the arguments against that. On the back of that is a map that shows, as of the end of the year, my analysis of how other states have weighted that. And I see that some of the industry group has handed out a much more attractive and colorful map that I think has basically the same information in it. So you can see the methods that are used by other states. Basically, the arguments in favor of single sales apportionment, which I suspect the proponents will make, is that this is a way to encourage business investment in Minnesota by companies that sell more of their goods outside of the state than their property and payroll factors are in the state. And so, and to the extent that you go to 100% sales apportionment, that basically essentially takes away the negative factor for a corporation from increasing its investment in Minnesota, either by hiring more employees or by putting more property in place. Because under the current formula, since that increases its property and payroll factor, which determine in part how much income is attributable to Minnesota of their overall profits, there's a sort of a tax penalty for doing that. In other words, building a building in Minnesota or hiring more employees has the effect, if you're a profitable multi-state corporation, of actually raising your Minnesota corporate tax, whereas if you use 100% sales apportionment and you're mix of sales in and outside the state doesn't change as a result of that investment, there's no effect on of that investment on the tax. Now, one of the things that going to single sales apportionment does, and you can see by comparing Representative Lencheski's bill that provides for optional apportionment with the bills that provide just single sales apportionment as the only technique. By comparing the revenue estimates, you can see that one of the effects of this bill is that it raises taxes on some corporations. Representative Lynchesky's optional bill costs $85 million, whereas the 100% in, I think, in fiscal year 05, whereas a bill that just goes to 100% sales apportionment immediately costs $43.7 million. So that you can see from that there's about $40 million of increases that will fall on some corporations, and those, of course, are corporations that have higher percentages of sales in Minnesota relative to their property and payroll. Last thing I'd like to point out is there's this white piece of paper that was handed out that has two tables on it, and that shows the different phase-ins under the various, under the five bills that are before the committee today. So you can see they've taken various different approaches to how quickly they get to single sales apportionment. And Representative Lynchesky's bill, 2588, is unique in that it has this optional apportionment that doesn't result in any corporation getting a tax increase as a right of, as a result of passage of this. The fiscal costs are summarized in the table on the bottom, and you can see obviously how the phase-ins affect the cost to the state and reduce corporate taxes. And one thing to note, as you look at those estimates, you'll note that they drop off in the out years, and that just is because the finance department forecast is that corporate franchise tax revenues will drop in the out years, and so that's the reason why the cost of the proposals drops. It's not inherent in the proposals, but rather it's the underlying tax that has that effect. Otherwise, with that, unless there are questions, I'll turn it over to Representative Lynchesky.
Let's see. Representative Lynchesky, you did have a technical amendment to your bill, the A1 amendment.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move that at this time.
Representative Lynchesky moves the A1 amendment. As many as are in favor of the amendment say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Lynchesky.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I know there are testifiers for this bill today, but I just wanted to add a little bit to what Joel Michael shared with the committee. And, Mr. Chair, I know that you and our DFL lead, Representative Pugh, and many bipartisan sort of tax policy wonks in this body and in the other body have understood the value of the single sales tax issue, single sales apportionment for Minnesota. It is a difficult issue because the public probably hasn't heard of it, probably isn't interested to understand much how it works, but it's really important, and I'm glad you're having this hearing today. Single sales is really a job creation tool for the Minnesota legislature.
Representative Mullery.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lynchesky, you said something about it wasn't, the public didn't understand it. How does it fit into the only issue I'm hearing anything about, gay marriage?
Pardon?
I said, how does this fit into the only issue I'm hearing anything about, gay marriage?
It has nothing to do with it.
Representative Mullery, it was your choice to serve on civil law.
Come on down.
The speaker didn't agree with that choice. You're not on civil law?
I didn't ask.
Do you want to be?
No. I could not ask first.
Representative Lynchesky.
Mr. Chair.
You know, the speaker is gone one day, Representative Mullery. We could get you on civil law. All it takes is a signature, Representative Mullery, and you're sentenced. Representative Lynchesky.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I know the other committees today have a lot juicier items than this, but you know, it really is our responsibility to do good policy, whether the public is paying attention to these kind of things or interested in them. And I think with our most recent numbers for jobs in Minnesota, this is a something all of us ought to be looking at really seriously. Like I said, it's a job creation tool. what it really does, if you go to 100% apportionment, you encourage it in businesses to either put new jobs in Minnesota or keep the jobs that are here in Minnesota. And it's interesting to note in the seven or other states that have passed this, that labor and business has lobbied for this together. This is a way to get more jobs in Minnesota. The history for us in this state is that in 1939 we were really the cutting edge in the state because we decided to let manufacturers double weight their sales factor. Then in 54 we let all firms do it, and so we were kind of leading the nation. Since that time, everyone else figured out how to catch up to Minnesota. By 1987, we went from optionally allowing people to do it the way we have it now to requiring people to do it the way we have it now. And now, for all of you to, you know, I'm sure you remember, it's 75% sales, 12.5% for property, 12.5% for payroll. So really the history there is that we used to have this huge advantage competitively in Minnesota, but we don't anymore. In fact, most economists project that all states will move to 100% single sales factoring, and so we really just can't ignore what's happening around us. The single sales apportionment really eliminates tax advantages that are received by those companies who move out of the state, and it stops that process from taking place. It keeps Minnesota competitive by ensuring that liabilities won't be increased, as Mr. Michael stated, when you decide to either have a facility here or have more employment here, which is what, all other things being equal, with all the states is happening currently. And we are particularly behind those seven or eight states who are ahead of us now. Some of the effects of this is, and I've tried to highlight that by introducing two bills, one with the phase-in to allow for single sales, and then the other one Mr. Michael referenced, which would say let's make it optional for corporations to do this. And that's really to just have you understand that there is a cost to this. As Mr. Michael said, you know, businesses who have a sales factor higher than their average of property and payroll would get a tax increase. And those are those sort of large national manufacturers with few facilities in Minnesota, like General Motors or Microsoft. So those are, you know, that's a recognition that we're not trying to reward companies that aren't putting jobs in Minnesota. So that is the intent of the legislation. Those businesses, conversely, whose sales factor is lower than property and payroll receive a tax cut. And then those businesses who are currently 100% Minnesota right now, nothing happens to them. They neither receive a benefit nor incur a cost. So, you know, there are different incidences of the tax falling on different businesses differently, and it washes out to the numbers you see in the fiscal note. But I guess the way to think about in shifting the total incidence is we're moving incidence of the tax, the economic effect of the sales factor really becoming a sales tax, and the incidence falling away from capital and instead to sales. So, Mr. Chair, you know, as I said, there are a number of people here to testify. I just got to meet them as I came in the room. But I just hope all of us as legislators can really look at this as a way to create jobs in Minnesota. Look at it bipartisanly. It's very pro-business and pro-labor, and I think it's something that's long overdue.
Any questions for Representative Lincheski? Representative Dorman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Lincheski. Right now we're at 75, 12.5. And can you help me understand what the proposal, what was it like before we went into session last year? And did we make any changes to this last year? And secondly, do you know what the proposals were from the administration last year?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Lincheski.
I'd like you or Mr. Michael to answer that question because I think we were at 60 and Representative Dorman's right that we did something, but I don't remember the exact how it was before we made the change. And then for Governor Pawlenty's proposal, of your two proposals and mine that we're hearing today, Representative Abrams, I don't know if he's doing, which one of these he's modeling. I think it's either 2432 or 2644 of the two House files we're looking at, but you would probably know better, Mr. Michael.
And Mr. Chair, I was wondering about last year.
Last year, Representative Dorman, there was no change, as I recall. There are a couple bills. I forgot if it made the House Omnibus Tax Bill or not, Representative Dorman. The years in which there have been changes in this, and Mr. Michael will correct me when I'm really wrong, is I believe 1999 and 2000 were the big changes. We tried in 2001 and were unsuccessful. Mr. Michael, am I correct in my recollection?
Mr. Chairman, it is correct. For many years, the state had a 70-15-15 formula, and that was changed to the current one in 1999. And there have been, the House has passed proposals, for example, in 2001, to increase the sales weighting, but none of those proposals since 99 has been enacted. So the current weighting was enacted by the 99 legislature.
And Representative Dorman, to your second question, I haven't seen the governor's proposal.
Mr. Chair, but there was not a proposal from the administration last year.
Representative Dorman, no, there was not. There was a proposal last week, and hopefully the folks at the department are putting it into a position in which we can discuss it, but I haven't seen it, so I can't comment as to exactly what they do, if it's a one-year deal, if it's a phase-in, how many years it's phased in. There are three factors here. Sales, payroll, and property. In the past we have dealt with the payroll and property on a even basis. You can stagger them as well. But I haven't seen their proposal, Representative Drummond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question perhaps for Mr. Michael, unless the author wants to handle it. I noticed on the cost of proposal sheet for the Lincheski House File 2588, the cost of that, even though it's implemented immediately and remains the same, the cost drops in 2007, which is consistent with our revenue forecast from November to February. The estimates in 2007 for corporate franchise tax revenues drops $100 million. What's going on that would have corporate franchise tax numbers drop from somewhere slightly over $800 million down to $700 million?
I think that's probably a question for Paul Wilson. Paul, what's going on here?
I have sent an email to back here in finance. I haven't heard a response yet.
Best I can do for you, Representative Pugh.
It seemed a little strange when we saw that number, and I notice that's reflected in the proposal cost of proposals in the Lincheski bill 2588.
So maybe Dr. Stinson is telling us to short the market in 2006 because corporate profits are going down. So. At this time, I'm going to call on the testifiers. Chris Kreider from Red Wing Shoes. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Kreider. Please identify yourself for the tape.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Chris Kreider, and I am the tax manager for Red Wing Shoe Company. Red Wing Shoe Company was founded in 1905 with our corporate offices, manufacturing, and distribution facilities located in Red Wing, Minnesota that employ about 1,800 people. We manufacture approximately 3 million pair of boots annually and sell to customers throughout the United States and the world. Roughly two-thirds of our annual payroll is paid to employees, I should say, based in Minnesota, and approximately half the property held by the company is also located in the state. However, only 5% of our sales occur within the state, and this leaves an apportionment percentage of approximately 24%. This means that 24% of our income is taxed here, even though only 5% of our income is earned here. So the current tax apportionment structure puts us at a disadvantage with our competitors who have not made any human and capital investment in Minnesota. If taxed with a single sales factor, Red Wing Shoe could be more competitive in our pricing, thereby growing revenue and profits. With 98% of all footwear sold in the United States coming from offshore facilities, we certainly could use some help. Adoption of the single sales factor legislation would help Red Wing Shoe Company to continue to make capital and human investments here in Minnesota. This is an issue that affects companies all over the state of Minnesota, and I encourage the legislature to act on this initiative this year to help Red Wing Shoe Company remain a vital employer in this state and competitive in the global marketplace. And thank you for your time and consideration of this issue.
Are there any questions for Mr. Kreider? Representative Mullery.
Mr. Chair, could I go back to Representative Lunchesky, one statement? I just thought of that.
Go back to Representative Lunchesky. Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
What about gay marriage again?
No. it's about, I thought you said that both employers and labor support that, and I was wondering about the labor, because in 2001, I remember specifically, they opposed the change when it was in the chairman's bill.
Representative Lunchesky.
Mr. Chair, I don't know about that. We could find that out. I'm sure someone from labor is in the room. What I said was that in the states that have passed it, Minnesota not being one, organized labor have been advocating and lobbying for its passage.
I didn't hear.
I don't know the Minnesota history, and quite frankly, I've been sort of confounded as to why labor hasn't been more active in ensuring this passage.
In my recollection, Representative Mullery, is that while the AFL-CIO was opposed, there were some constituent unions that were lobbying the Senate Democrats in favor. The IAM was, that's, you know, just some memories of it, and there may have been another one or two, but there were some constituent members of the AFL-CIO who were lobbying. I mean, real unions, you know, what you and I would think are unions, not...
Right.
Thank you. Representative Dempsey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Kreider, I know that you've been, Red Wing Shoe has laid off employees, and I'd just like your perspective as to this piece of legislation, what effect would that have on more people being laid off at Red Wing Shoe?
Mr. Kreider.
Representative Dempsey, I can't quote specific numbers to you. That's part of the job of an economist. I'm a mere tax accountant. I can tell you it would help us become more competitive, though. It's an extremely competitive marketplace. We compete with companies all over the world. There aren't many companies that are doing what we're trying to do here in this country. As I mentioned, 98% of all footwear sold in the U.S. comes from offshore facilities. We're one of the few in this country that are trying to do what we can to maintain a manufacturing base in this state. So I can't specifically address your question and tell you that it might create another 25 jobs, for example, but it certainly would help in keeping those jobs here.
And Mr. Chairman?
Representative Dempsey.
We had a meeting, by we I mean some of the officials of the company, Red Wing Shoe, and they are in the process of some reorganization within the company and so on. And this piece of legislation is brought forth at a very good time, and I'm hopeful that there will be a positive vote on this, because it certainly means a lot to the city of Red Wing and also to the state of Minnesota for jobs.
Representative Dempsey, any more questions for Mr. Kreider? Thank you for coming forward, sir. Jody Farragut, Hormel Meats. Did you get the T-shirt to the governor that he wore in Iraq, or did he go and buy it, or?
I believe we'll hear more about that on Friday. Governor Pawlenty will be
what?
Speaking.
We do have an anti-spam filter, Representative Magnus. Ms. Berrigan, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the tape.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Jody Farragut, and I'm the Vice President and Treasurer for Hormel Foods Corporation. Part of my responsibilities include responsibility for the tax area, although I will profess to not being a tax expert. As you know, Hormel Foods Corporation, founded over 110 years ago, in Minnesota is a multinational marketer of consumer-branded meat and food products, and we're headquartered in Austin, Minnesota. We employ over 16,000 employees worldwide. Our significant base of operations is in the Midwest, including the state of Minnesota, as well as Iowa, Illinois, Nebraska, and Wisconsin. All of the states that we do business in the Midwest, excluding Minnesota, have enacted a single sales factor or have a plan, as Wisconsin does, for a four-year phase-in. Over 50% of our workforce is in the state of Minnesota, and we have significant operational assets, including our 1.2 million square foot headquarter facility in Austin. Every job we create and every investment we make in Minnesota costs us more than a job created in another one of those states because of the apportionment factors used in calculating the Minnesota tax. This places us at a competitive disadvantage to our peers that operate in states without the job weighting or asset weighting factors. We consider several things when we look at expanding our operations. Part of that's the overall tax climate, proximity to our raw materials, our workforce and distribution, the economic incentives offered, as well as overall regulatory climates, permitting, etc. We do applaud the efforts of the governor and the bipartisan support of your committee and the legislature in addressing this inequality, and do look forward to the day when the playing field is level for those chosen to make investments in jobs and assets in Minnesota. Thank you for your time.
Any questions for Ms. Farragut?
Thank you very much, Nancy.
Thank you.
Brett Scribner, tax manager, the Lux Corporation. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself at the table.
Good morning. My name is Brett Scribner. I am the Director of Tax for Deluxe Corporation. I want to thank you, Mr. Chairman, and representatives for this, giving me this chance to speak to you briefly today about this very important economic development initiative. Deluxe is headquartered in Shoreview, Minnesota. It was incorporated in Minnesota in 1920, and we've maintained our headquarters in Minnesota for 84 years. Deluxe is the world's leading check printer, both in terms of revenue and number of checks produced, and serve small businesses, financial institutions, and consumers directly through our three business units. Deluxe is a Fortune 1000 company, was recently ranked in the Pioneer Press as the 23rd largest company in Minnesota by market cap. We are proud to employ over 1,100 people in Shoreview today and over 5,000 nationally. Here in Minnesota, we employ our corporate administration, senior leadership, as well as marketing, finance, IT, sales, and engineering administration. We also operate a call center right next to the headquarters building on the same campus. These are good jobs with good wages, and Deluxe views itself as one of the premier employers in Minnesota today. The payments industry is highly competitive. We face considerable competition from at least six other check printers, and we expect competition to intensify as the check printing portion of the industry continues to mature and decline. We also face challenges from alternative bill presentment and payment systems, ATM machines, credit cards, and debit cards. The perspective I want to bring to you today is that of a longtime Minnesota good corporate citizen, one who is facing tough challenges in a maturing industry. As check writing has peaked and is now declining, our company is being pushed and challenged every day to lower our costs and bring enhanced value to our shareholders. It's particularly important to realize that call centers and corporate headquarters, administrative functions and management functions are relatively portable, and we must operate these functions in the most cost-effective manner possible, and that means in the most cost-effective locations possible. Deluxe clearly intends to remain headquartered in Minnesota and not only keep the good-paying jobs we have here, but expand our employment in the state. As we analyze our human resource needs, we always evaluate the business climate because we compete for talent across the country. One of the key elements in any of those analyses are a thorough evaluation of the tax climate. The bottom line is that adding a job here costs more than adding it in several other states, as you can see from your map. As more states move to 100% sales, the advantage Minnesota companies once had has steadily eroded. This puts us at a competitive disadvantage when we are trying to add jobs here and keep the jobs we have here. We at Deluxe believe that repealing the jobs tax is one powerful way to really help all Minnesota-based businesses grow and create jobs. We also believe that we must move to 100% sales factor as soon as possible, certainly at least as fast, if not faster, than our good friends across the river in Wisconsin. In order to restore the competitive advantage to all Minnesota companies, we ask that you phase in as quickly as possible to keep us ahead of the wave. Minnesota needs to get back in front where we used to be. I can't overstate what an important factor the tax climate is when our business considers site location and expansion. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, representatives, for allowing me to speak on this matter.
Any questions for Mr. Scribner? Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And earlier in the present financial straits of the status of the state, we are a little short of money, $160 million. In order to do what you're asking, we're going to have to find additional revenue somewhere. How do you feel about gambling being a part of the solution to your problem? In other words, if we raise money through some gambling device and apply it to what you have as a problem, how do you feel about that? Or how does your company feel about it? How do the rest of the companies that are testifying feel about it?
Mr. Scribner.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, my company hasn't really formulated a, I can't give you a really clear answer as to whether we would support a gambling-related initiative.
Well, Mr. Chairman, you ought to think about it, because that's going to be the ultimate solution, I believe.
I'll bet you.
What?
Any further questions? I think you're part of another conversation. Boy, are you going to get funny-looking checks next time?
Yeah.
Any further questions for Mr. Scribner? Or Representative Ruth?
Thank you, Chair Abrams. The bill that I have does pays in the same time as Wisconsin, and you had made reference to that, and I just wonder if you could talk to that some.
Well, clearly the Wisconsin will be fully 100% sales, I believe, for the 2008. If we just follow the same timeline based on the percentages that we have for the phase-in, we will kind of stay ahead of Wisconsin just by nature fact that we're kind of ahead right now. And so if we follow the same timeline, we'll get to 100% at the same time, but until we get there, we'll still stay ahead of Wisconsin.
Any further questions? Thank you very much. Next name on the list is Steve Kupke from Lewis Rich Corporation, Albert Lee, Representative Dorman.
Mr. Chair, take it easy on Mr. Tufte. He's had a tough couple of years. Guy used to live in a very peaceful neighborhood out at the end of a dead-end road, and some crazed tire dealer built a house next to him. And so he's had a tough couple of years, and is still adjusting into that. So.
What he's telling you, Mr. Chair, is he's my neighbor.
Please identify yourself with the tape. I think that every member of the committee has some questions for you.
Some relating to the bill.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. My name is Steve Tufte. I'm the CFO of Lou Rich in Albert Lea, Minnesota. Lewis Rich is the turkey processor. We're the contract manufacturer. So just so we have that up front. Lou Rich, contract manufacturing. We were established in 1972 by two gentlemen as a tool and die shop in a small town near Albert Lea, Minnesota. Been in existence over 30 years. We have currently over 280 employees. 260 of them are located in Minnesota. Contract manufacturing involves basically providing original equipment manufacturers with assemblies and components for their final products. We've grown substantially here over the years. We have over 90% of our employees in Minnesota, 90% of our assets are in Minnesota. And to give you some comparison as far as how this bill or what's being proposed affects us, a comparison of 2002 with like sales in Iowa versus Minnesota, there's a 45% difference in the tax being paid between the two states. And if you take the current apportionment and compare it to 100%, The difference in Minnesota is 121%. So it's a significant impact on us as far as from a tax standpoint, which really impacts our company because we are an ESOP. We're 63% owned by the ESOP, or Employee Stock Ownership Plan. And the remaining stock is owned by former or current employees outside of the ESOP. So they have a real buy-in as far as what the impact is of these types of things on the company. The other thing we face is we face a very big competition from offshore competitors, because and our large customers, they do look offshore, and any competitive advantage we can gain here as far as in a bidding process against those companies is just a benefit for us for keeping those products and being able to manufacture them in the United States. That's all I have. If there's any questions.
Any questions? Representative Jacobson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Tufte, thank you for being here today to testify. And on behalf of the committee, I think we can send you home with our deepest sympathy.
Mr. Chair. Representative Rucavina.
Mr. Tufte, how many waste tires does Representative Dorman have on his property?
None that I've seen so far, but I guess we'll have to search a little harder. We'll have stories afterwards if you want.
Mr. Tufte, has Representative Dorman had you over to his house for all-you-can-eat crab night?
No, you know, I haven't been over there for that yet, so...
Pork, though. Pork. Jerry has been over for pork barbecue, I believe.
That's right. So...
Soon, Representative. I should point out that one of his offspring, Kramer, who was kind of the job foreman when we built our house, that's their chocolate lab, he's been over a lot for dinner.
Yes. He feeds him very well, by the way.
Any further questions for Mr. Tufte? We have a very heavy burden, sir, and we hope that we help lift it for you.
Thank you for having me.
Jenny Ying. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself at the table.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jenny Yang, and I work at Dorsey & Whitney Law Firm, and the Single Sales Factor Coalition is one of my clients, and you've heard from just some of our members today. I wanted to just add to the testimony that we believe there will be a significant stimulus with passing 100% sales weighting. And I'm sharing now, she's seen it before, but with Representative Lencheski, there was a study done in 1999, which I know was a different economic time, by a professor out of the University of Illinois. He did studies in Minnesota, Wisconsin, Illinois, and Indiana, looking at 100% sales weighting. At the time, and again, it was a different economic time, he estimated about 44,000 new jobs, with creating an additional $43 million in personal tax revenue. Now, there have been several studies done on both sides of the argument, but we can't help but believe that if there's not a penalty for adding jobs, that you won't see an increase in income tax. We also understand, though, that the Department of Revenue does not do this kind of dynamic modeling, but it is something to think about as you're examining this issue. And that's the only thing, Mr. Chairman. I'd be happy to answer questions.
Any questions for Ms. Zink? The next name on the list is Wayne Cox, Executive Director, Minnesota Citizens for Tax Justice. Oh, there was a question? Is there anybody from revenue here? Well, I see the usual suspects, but do you have a question, Representative Mallory? Or?
Mr. Chairman, I have a question, and it's not real focused yet. It's forming in my mind. I don't know who to ask it of, but if this is such an important factor, why are most of the mergers that occur with large Minnesota corporations, they move it into a state with far less of an advantage on this issue?
Kind of an interesting question to ask Ms. Ng. But it's kind of interesting. On some of them, they don't. On Wells Fargo, there's been an increase in the headquarters corporation. In Pillsbury, they left and they came back. They did come back, Representative Mallory, because when General Mills bought Pillsbury, there's a large building going up on 394 and 169 that's supposed to be
taking some management staff, so I think that, I'm trying to think of some that have worked the other way. I'm sure that there are others. Honeywell, now a New Jersey corporation. The year after Mr. Bonsiore was the was the president of the Minnesota Business Partnership. for those of us keeping score. It's kind of an interesting question, Representative Mallory.
I mean, I don't have facts, but I've obviously they're going one way, and I don't know if there's others to balance it out. But how does that affect it? And
Representative Lucheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Mallory. That is interesting to think about, and I guess the way I'd think about it is location is, you know, a decision, a business decision made by many factors, not just this. So if you're able to hold this constant, then you could probably empirically make some sort of assumptions, but I don't think you can. And there's some real legitimate arguments as to what is this doing, where is the incidence going to fall on sales or consumers versus capital. But when all the other states are heading in this direction, it gets difficult to argue that we should be an island. And so at that point, when we all are 100% sales, then I think people can really make that assertion that, you know, everything is something is happening unrelated to this. And right now, because it's moving and it's moving quickly, most legislatures are considering getting to where those other eight states are. It's just hard to say, you know, other than like you're saying anecdotally. And I wouldn't be able to, I don't know how we'd even find the answer to that question.
Well, we have an enterprising staff for panel. Let's just maybe they can figure out a model to
figure out anything.
Mr. Cox, welcome to the committee. We've first time here this year.
Thank you,
back.
Mr. Chairman. Pleasure to be here as always. I'm Wayne Cox. I'm Executive Director of Minnesota Citizens for Tax Justice. I don't know, it was a couple years ago or maybe three that the committee had an extensive hearing on this same subject, and we appeared at that time and testified against the proposition to move toward a single sales factor. Minnesota Citizens for Tax Justice, for the members who don't know, our primary supporters are labor organizations here in the state, the Minnesota AFL-CIO, Farmers Union, Senior Federation, and others. The concern is several. The first is that in some of the states where this has been tried, it has been problematic. In Illinois, an example I brought to you two or three years ago, some of the sponsors and supporters of moving in that direction were very, very shocked at the revenue loss that incurred at a level much, much higher than had been anticipated. It caused severe disruption in the fiscal system in Illinois and was quite a problem. So anything that might cause potential further discombobulation in your already rather strained fiscal system in Minnesota is something you want to consider very, very carefully. Secondly, what you're doing here is taking a sector of state revenue that is probably your most robust sector of state revenue, which is corporate profits, and taking revenue from that source at a time when your revenue sources elsewhere are pretty much problematic. Wages across the country in the last 9 months were under a 1.5% increase, about a 10-year low. Capital gains, we're having a little bit of an increase, but we have so much backlog of loss carry forwards that we're not going to get a lot of net new revenue in that source anytime soon. So personal income is really problematic for the state. We've been missing our mark in personal income. So corporate income is something we've been doing fairly well on, although the last month or two not quite as well. But it is a robust source. This Sunday's paper, the St. Paul Pioneer Press did their annual 100 top companies in market value, and found robust growth in the state in the leading companies in terms of revenue, in terms of earnings, over 100% increase in earnings, over a 37% increase in market value. So earnings, market value, profits are doing quite well in the state overall, and it's a revenue source that we ought not to be turning our back on gratuitously. Now, if we were to expect that we would, by virtue of going to single sales factor, materially impact the economic vitality of the state, we would have reason to think that it might be a potentially good source of revenue if the gains outweighed the loss of revenue. It's very doubtful that you're going to get any material gain from this. Number one, you have an awful lot of losers, people who are going to have their tax, firms will have their taxes increased, and you'll have some that will have their taxes decreased. Well, some of the ones that would have their taxes decreased are doing quite well under our current system. They're among those top 100 firms in the state, and they're by and large doing quite well in terms of growth. So we don't think that this is sort of a solution in search of a problem. Economically, the firms are doing well in terms of profits. Minnesota is hard pressed to get adequate revenue sources. That is, it should not turn its back in an area of robust revenue growth when our other sources are much more moribund. Secondly, the other sort of couple issues. One is that Minnesota has argued that, well, this will be particularly beneficial to the manufacturing sector. Well, Minnesota has competed in the manufacturing arena forever. And how have we performed? Well, during the 1980s, we increased our market share of the nation's manufacturing. During 1990s, we increased our market share of the nation's manufacturing. And during the year 2000, even though we have lost jobs in Minnesota in manufacturing, we have nonetheless increased our market share in manufacturing compared to other states in the nation. Minnesota in manufacturing, as well as the other sectors, is a state where businesses not only compete, they win. Minnesota has a dynamic business economy that has found the type of structure that is available here in terms of educated workforce, good transportation systems and the like have allowed these companies a great deal of capability to grow and grow well. And they are capably managed and have taken advantage of that. So will we receive any net new benefit? We've done well, better than other states under that have this regime and other states nationally. In states like Illinois, I mentioned that it was very problematic. Some of the supporters were very concerned afterwards that they had lost a lot more revenue. There was a big controversy in Massachusetts after it was adopted in much the same lines. So this is not a clear, easy issue. Certainly, some firms would receive some tax benefit that they don't now enjoy. By and large, on net, Minnesota's firms, I don't anticipate we would have any extensive amount of net economic gain. We would have some economic loss for those who would have the regime. But really, the last thing to think about in this kind of an issue is, if you're talking about $40 million or if you're talking about $21 million, you need to think about the opportunity cost. The opportunity cost is that, well, what if that money that stayed in the state coffers and were used to, for instance, remove the diminished position you put the University of Minnesota in terms of its capacity to be able to hire and retain adequate research faculty and hence continue to be as dynamic a source for creating the new jobs of the future as it has been. What if that money were used to accelerate the capacity of our community colleges and our K-12 system to be able to provide the talented workforce of the future? And it's that workforce, frankly, that has given Minnesota its economic advantage.
Representative Dorman has a question. Representative Dorman.
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess, Mr. Cox, I'd be curious about a couple things. Your comments, you talk about how we're doing well relative to other states. I have the good fortune to serve on the Jobs and Economic Development Finance Committee, and one of the things that committee learned last year when we were taking a look at the Job Z zones is that relative to the state of Iowa, of which you know, we in Albert Lee feel we are the defenders of Minnesota from Iowa, because you got to come right through us to get there, that Iowa has lost manufacturing jobs, and so has Minnesota in the past 5 years, but as a percentage, we've lost them twice as fast. One of the things that's different about Minnesota and Iowa is a single factor. There may be other things, but relative to Iowa, we appear to be losing manufacturing jobs at a much faster rate. And I'm glad you brought up opportunity cost, because I think this is one of the issues that we need to look at and think about. What is in the long-term benefit of the state? Do we say, gee, we did good in the 80s, so we'll probably be good forever? Or do we look and see what other states, how they've responded to it, and what's the opportunity cost of not doing it in jobs that we don't create? Because a job not created, I can tell you, pays no tax to Minnesota. And so I look at this as something that we're doing, or hopefully doing, not for today necessarily, but for the next generation, to make sure that our job economy is good, not next week, but in the next decade.
Representative Dorman, you can answer a question of mine. I have heard about a number of projects in the Albert Lee, Austin, Fairmont area in which those cities were competing for things like distribution plants and
Wisconsin
processing facilities.
Iowa. Kansas City.
Yeah. And, you know, I could think of at least four times in which either legislators or the governor's office under Governor Ventura came to me and, you know, asked my opinion or my help in various things. And it's very difficult to win that competition. Is my memory hazy on this, or do I recollect pretty correctly that Albert Lee had a couple opportunities, Austin had an opportunity, Fairmont had an opportunity, and it was all, I believe, gone to states not that far away. Am I correct in my recollection? You live down there, so you can help me.
Mr. Chair, I think the best example would be a Ford distribution plant that they were looking at putting in, looked at by Stuartville and Representative Queasley's area. They looked at Albert Lee. They looked at several places. They end up citing that in Menominee, Wisconsin. They listed four or five things. On the list was the difference in corporate income tax, and chose to locate in Wisconsin. So it does have an impact. Those were jobs that were going to pay significantly above what the current market is in the Albert Lee area, and those employees are now sitting in Menominee, Wisconsin, and the direct impact is to the state of Wisconsin, both in the payroll taxes and the other things. We had a meatpacking opportunity that is in, we lost to Kansas, and so there are several. It's we don't win very many, Mr. Chair. We've had much better success in my neck of the woods with companies like Lou Rich, that started in a very small facility in Hayward, Minnesota, and then grew to what they are today. But they are under increased competition, in their case, from Asia and other places when they go to the contract manufacturing that they do. A lot of times they'll be in on the first or second round of something, and all of a sudden, boom, it's gone, and it's off somewhere else. And so when they go bid a project, these types of things definitely impact their cost structure, which impacts the job creation.
I think there's also a food distribution center in the area.
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Chairman, I was just going to, you mentioned Fairmont, and I imagine you're hearing a lot this year about an issue between a plant going in Fairmont or just into Iowa, but I've heard an awful lot about that, but not this factor has not ever been mentioned as one of the factors that problem. I'm sure you're hearing about that one.
Yeah. It's been broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Cox, I'm trying to understand your perspective, and so maybe you can help me out a little bit. In your testimony, you talk about the problematic appearance of this in your mind, and you talk about money better spent by public entities such as the University of Minnesota in terms of investment. So I'm trying to, I guess, understand why public spending is less problematic in your mind than investment in private job creation by private companies. So who's a better job creator, public or private, in your mind? I guess I'm not understanding why job growth is bad.
Mr. Cox.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, it's sort of a chicken or the egg. Ultimately, job creation is a combination of forces, public investments and private investments. In Minnesota, the public investment has been an extraordinary contributor to Minnesota's job growth because we've had a comparative advantage in having a better educated workforce, a workforce that has the capacity to add more value to products, to be more productive. Minnesota has been able, generally, to have higher value-added firms. And so the public investment is a very important ingredient in the capacity of the private sector to grow and compete in an ever-changing dynamic marketplace. And my concern, frankly, is that we have weakened our capacity in the public sector to be able to provide and maintain that comparative advantage. So it's a combination of both, Representative, and I would commend to you that you need to think about the effects on both arms of the job development equation. With respect to whether or not we've lost firms because of a single sales factor, I haven't really seen anything that would convince me that there's any instance where that has occurred. We sometimes see firms cite a multitude of things when they go elsewhere, which they seldom do, by the way, because we do, on net, grow faster than most other states. Quite often, in a case like Wisconsin, what happens is it isn't your overall system, tax system, that is weighed one to the other. Basically, what happens in Wisconsin is they'll come in and throw in a bunch of money on a deal and buy the land or buy something else or do a special one-time-only tax abatement kind of a thing that will simply overwhelm things. So that occasionally occurs, and that's also quite a bit of a problem because you're investing an awful lot of public money in those kind of instances. So you have to be careful about that. With respect to single sales factor, is it a driving factor in terms of business costs? The firm of Bugby Anton, Paul Anton is one of the state's members of the State Council of Economic Advisors, a few years back took a look at Minnesota's government-imposed costs and looked at all of them, added them all up. And what they found was that Minnesota's government-imposed costs would rank it right about in the middle of states that it would be conceivably, they looked at about 17 states that it would conceivably, theoretically, be in competition with. So if you add up all the costs together, basically Minnesota's government-imposed costs on businesses are not particularly out of line with those in other states. So if you look at the whole picture, you find that on balance, so we certainly do have the offer firms the capacity to compete and grow, and indeed they do.
Any other questions for Mr. Cox, Representative Lucheski?
Mr. Chair, well, really, probably just in closing, I know you want to deal with AMT, and that's really upsetting.
Day, yes.
Yeah, that'll get everybody upset. But I do just want to just comment, listening to everybody. You know, one of the things that frustrates me the most as a legislator is that so many of these issues get polarized so quickly. And I think that it's our job to not say only the private sector can do efficiently grow jobs or only the public investments can. The truth is they both can. We need to do both. I agree with Mr. Cox that we did weaken our capacity. I think what we've done over the last few years in higher education is a huge mistake. But that doesn't mean that this is a bad idea, because there have been, you know, a failure to invest in other things that were good ideas. So the concern I have is that people will just fall into one camp or the other quickly rather than looking long and hard at this issue. I have to take issue with the statement that the corporate franchise tax is the most robust part of our state revenue system. I just don't agree with that. But I do agree with what Mr. Cox said about, you know, it's doubtful you might get gains. That's true. A lot of what we do is to stem losses. I mean, it doesn't, you know, we think of us as individuals acting in the economic market. We buy health insurance. We pay premiums. We do lots of things. We sign wills, not because we're going to get some benefit, but to stem our losses when something goes wrong. And I guess my concern about, you know, the opportunity cost argument, boy, that really is correct. You know, Minnesota has one of the highest corporate income tax structures right now in the country at 9.8, and our current state system gives companies a tax decrease if they leave the state. So, I mean, think about that. You know, so I guess it's an argument that there's some legitimacy on either side, but I would just propose to you that when this map, whoever passed this out, is half read, most of the arguments against this are going to go away. And when it's three-quarters read, no one will even consider opposing this. I mean, we just cannot get where we used to be the leading state in the country. We are falling behind, and this map is just going to get redder and redder. And I know we all have our, you know, our groups that we, you know, you are used to listening to more than others, but we really need to listen to everybody on this issue. And the appeal to me on this is jobs. It isn't to give this business a tax cut. And remember, a whole bunch of businesses are going to get a tax increase under this proposal. So it does work both ways. But the businesses who get those increases are the people who haven't invested the jobs in our economy. Their jobs are in other states. So we want to reward the people who are employing people in this state.
Anybody else wish to testify either for or against House File 2432 as amended? I did want to correct or amplify one thing you said, Representative Lincheski, because I know that the business community sometimes points to the 9.8% rate. Minnesota is also a state that doesn't have throwback rules and a couple of other things that other states have with the lower rate. And when you take a look at the system as a whole, are we on the high end? Yes. Are we outrageously high if you just compare the rates? No. So I wanted to,
I agree.
I mean, they may take away a couple. The business community may take away a couple awards that they've given me over the years because I point that out. But I think that the apportionment is a problem, but that the system itself.
I agree, and I'm glad we didn't spend time on throwback, because that would just really we could do that forever. But you know, Mr. Chair, I haven't gotten any awards from the business community.
Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have one more quick question in regards to 2588, which essentially holds or allows businesses to have an opportunity to choose or self-select their tax structure or their apportionment. How many of those other states that have moved into single sales have done that, if any?
I don't think any. And I did it, I introduced it to just highlight that if you want to hold everybody harmless, it's going to cost you significantly more.
Okay.
And for those who would not want to harm a company that really isn't a Minnesota company, you know, they would support that legislation. I think there's reason to just support people who are creating jobs in Minnesota.
I see no further discussion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Yeah. I see no further discussion. This time, the chair will lay over House File 2432 as amended for further consideration, possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. We will now move on to House File 2643. Chair will move that House File 2643 be recommended to pass and considered for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Nina Manzi, an overview of the state alternative minimum tax, so that members know exactly what we're talking about here.
Okay.
Or Joel will do this. That's
good. Well, Mr. Chairman, we're going to do it.
Either is good.
We're going to do a tag team here.
Okay.
What we're going to do is to try to give a quick overview of the AMT, just so you have some background as to how the tax works. There is a handout in your folder that we're going to largely follow. Looks something like this. The AMT, the purpose of the AMT really is to make sure that higher income taxpayers pay at least some percentage of their income in tax, no matter how many tax preferences they have. It started with the Tax Reform Act of 1969 at the federal level. There was a Treasury Department study that came out in the middle 60s that showed that there were a number of millionaires who paid no tax, and I can't remember whether that meant $1 million of I think it must have meant $1 million of income. In any case, the AMT was enacted by Congress in response to that. The Minnesota legislature responded in the 80s by piggybacking on the federal AMT. The federal AMT has gone through a number of different permutations before it got to the current system. Basically, the structure of an alternative minimum tax is that there's a whole second tax system that's created, or a shadow tax system. That tax system usually has a much broader base, has a large exemption, and lower tax rates. And taxpayers who have income above that exemption level have to calculate their tax both ways to see which way is higher. If the AMT is higher, they have to pay the additional tax as an essentially add-on to their regular tax. So they pay the higher tax if the broader base with the fewer preferences and deductions and so forth result in that higher tax rate. There's a chart in the handout on page 2 that details the differences among the four taxes. And Nina will, as we get to our tag team element here, Nina will now take over and go through the nitty-gritty of the alternative tax systems.
Both the Minnesota regular tax, the federal regular tax, and then the two AMTs start with adjusted gross income. Then on the AMT, there are various tax-based adjustments that are carried through from the federal AMT to the Minnesota one. And after that, individuals are allowed a flat standard deduction amount on the AMT. For Minnesota, this amount is $40,000 for married couples filing joint returns. This compares to the much smaller standard deduction of $9,700 under our regular tax. On the federal AMT, I see that we're one federal tax temporary change behind on this. It's listed as $49,000 in tax year 04. The actual amount is $58,000, but that is going to revert to $45,000 next year, absent any new federal legislation. The federal government has dealt with their AMT issue by enacting a series of temporary increases in the standard deduction amount, and those are all scheduled to expire after tax year 04. Moving on to the personal exemptions, on the regular tax, you get $3,100 for the taxpayer, the spouse, and each dependent, and that amount's indexed annually for inflation. And then there is no additional amount allowed to be exempted under either AMT for personal or dependent exemptions. And the itemized deductions, the regular tax allows the deduction of mortgage interest. This is not allowed under Minnesota's AMT. It is allowed on the federal AMT, but only for first homes or loans used to improve your first home. And you can see that that's bolded and italicized there in Minnesota AMT to highlight that this is an item where we differ from the federal AMT. You'll see that there's several of those items in the table, and those tend to be the things where we focus and ways to reform Minnesota's AMT are the things that we do differently from the federal. The next one is charitable contributions, in which Minnesota now allows the deduction of the amount of contributions over 1% of adjusted gross income. The federal AMT allows the full amount. Property taxes are not allowed under either. Casualty losses are allowed under both. There's miscellaneous deductions that are not allowed under either. And then there's other miscellaneous deductions not subject to the 2% regular tax AGI threshold that Minnesota does not allow, but the federal AMT does allow. The one that gets the most attention of these tends to be gambling losses in excess of winnings. And from time to time, we'll hear of an issue where there's an individual who had a large winnings at gambling,
and they also are claiming large losses, and they have been thrown onto Minnesota's AMT as a result of this. So from time to time we'll hear a story like that, and there may be legislation introduced to allow the deduction of gambling losses on Minnesota's AMT. So that's the final item, and you'll see when we look at the two pieces of legislation that we have today that the first three bold and italicized items on this list are the items that those bills address. They propose to change the exemption amount by increasing it and indexing it. One of them proposes to allow a portion of mortgage interest as a deduction, and they both propose to allow the full amount of charitable contributions to be deducted on a phased-in schedule, in which that 1% threshold would decrease over a number of years. See, the next items we get down to are the tax rates, where you see a comparison of the regular rates and the AMT rate. This is, again, this is a reason why the AMT is less of a problem at the state level than at the federal level, because when we reduced our regular tax rates in 1999 and 2000, we also reduced the AMT rate in an effort to keep from moving people off of the regular tax and onto the AMT. The federal government has not done the same. In these last rounds of rate reductions that they've made, they have left the AMT rates at their two-tier level of 26 and 28%. Finally, you can see a little bit about the credits there and which state tax credits are allowed against the AMT. Now I'll turn it back to Joel.
Next thing I'd like to talk a little bit about is who pays the Minnesota AMT. Obviously, the first thing is that it's limited to taxpayers who have income that exceeds those exemption amounts. So for a married joint filer, they have to have at least $40,000 of income before they can possibly pay the AMT. And usually, since they'll be paying typically some regular tax, it's got to be somewhat above that. So taking that first premise, it's people that have income above those exemption amounts. And then secondly, what are the characteristics of the group of taxpayers that tends to throw them into the AMT? First of all, it's ones who have significant numbers of deductions that are allowed under the regular tax but that are not allowed under the AMT. Typically, this would be, as Nina went through, mortgage interest and property taxes and so forth. So anyway, if a taxpayer has high enough income and has a lot of those kinds of deductions, that can trigger a state AMT. The second big group is because there's no family size adjustment in that exemption amount that Nina described. It's just a flat amount for depending upon filing status. Folks that have large families and get many dependent exemptions also can, particularly if they have a combination of some of these other itemized deductions that aren't allowed under the AMT but are allowed under the regular tax, they can be triggered into the AMT. So folks with larger families tend to be another category. There's a table in the middle of page 3 that shows the amount of revenue that's been collected under the AMT in 2001, 2002, and then it shows the Department of Finance estimates for future revenues from the tax. And you can see that it's projected to grow fairly substantially. It's been relatively stable in 01 and 02 at $26 million, but the Department of Finance is projecting that it's going to grow to $46 million by tax year 06. Why are these revenues growing so fast? I think Nina and I think that the basic reason for that is indexing. One of the features of the, as I think most of you know, the regular tax is indexed so that as inflation increases, the personal exemption amount increases, the standard deduction increases, and the width of the brackets increase. So indexing holds taxpayers constant against price changes for those features of the tax. By contrast, the AMT exemption amount is not indexed. The state set it based on the federal exemption back in 1982. And so every year as time passes with inflation, that exemption gets eroded. If it had been indexed back starting in 1982, instead of $40,000 for a married joint filer now, it would be $77,000. So you get a feel for the effect of that, so that we keep indexing the regular tax but not the AMT. And so So that's a factor. The legislature has also enacted a few really minor sort of tax preferences that were allowed under the regular tax and not under the AMT. That's probably a small factor. I think probably many of you have seen in the media federal estimates that just show this huge ballooning of the number of taxpayers that will be subject to the federal AMT. Minnesota doesn't have quite that big a problem because, as Nina pointed out, unlike the federal Congress, when they enacted the big tax cuts in 01 and 03, and actually back in 98, too, there was a tax cut, they never adjusted the AMT rates. They've done these sort of temporary increases in the exemption that don't have as long a duration as the tax cuts that they were intended to offset. So when federal estimators do estimates, it just shows that huge numbers of taxpayers will be shifted to the AMT unless Congress takes some action. It's not quite that dire at the state level, but this indexing factor is just regularly shifting more Minnesota taxpayers onto our AMT, and that will continue unless the legislature does something.
Representative Pugh.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Michael, the revenue numbers shown on page 3 for, is that, that'll be collections from AMT filers. Do we know the number of, what would they have paid under their regular tax? Do we know how much more, or is that what this requires?
Mr. Michael.
Mr. Chairman, no, this is just the additional tax that they pay as a result of the AMT. Okay. We could have it calculated to see what the regular tax is, too, but that's something we've never tabulated that, but that it would be possible to tabulate that. And that is likely to be a substantial, that's likely to be a very big number because many of these folks are high-income taxpayers that already pay a substantial amount of tax, some of them. One of the things that the tax is doing is beginning to become more of a sort of upper-middle income tax as a result of this indexing factor.
Thank you.
Representative Lincheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question for Mr. Michael or Ms. Manzi. You mentioned the congressional cuts, cutting marginal rates under the regular income and not reducing the AMT rates, and then you also mentioned the inflation. You know, those two components affecting this. Which one's probably a bigger factor, or could you put a ratio to them? Is it kind of like a 4-to-1 or 50-50? Or, I mean, what do you think is causing it, given those two factors you just explained?
Michael?
We have, quite honestly, Mr. Chairman, Representative Lincheski, we have not done really any analysis of the federal. I've read some of the reports, and, some of them actually have, there's some kind of game playing that goes in some of the estimates that are done not by the federal government estimators, but by private estimators, because they occasionally assume that the tax, that the sort of the Bush tax cuts are permanent, whereas the AMT fixes are not permanent. I think the tax cuts probably is a bigger factor. The Minnesota effect of not indexing is sort of a baseline probably that gives you a little bit of a feel for what the indexing component of it is. But it's hard to speculate. I'm sure that they could decompose those numbers. But it's not something we really have a capacity to do to analyze the federal tax.
So for everybody who wants to move to a flat tax, here it is. Members, very briefly, what House File 2643 does is if you take a look at the comparison of the regular tax and the Minnesota AMT, there are two or three what I would consider pressure points in which you can try to eliminate the most number of people from the AMT at the least amount of money. And this bill basically chooses two of those. There's a phase out of the charitable contribution, and that is, again, I think, a position that's felt fairly strongly by most members of the House after the Chapman case. We took a swing at it in a special session in 2002. We took another chunk out in 2003, and then
this continues a phase out. The second pressure point that this uses is the standard deduction amount. And I had Nina Manzi run a couple of scenarios, and the higher you move the exemption amount, the more people you throw off, and you're also throwing off people with the lowest income who do get subjected to the alternative minimum tax. And I think that the estimate, Nina, was that when it's fully phased in, that somewhere around 35 to 38% of the AMT filers would be not filing AMT but regular returns. And what the phase out, what this does is it increases the deduction by $2,000 a year for 5 years up to $50,000. And we think that that's the result. If we do nothing, on page three, we're going to have a geometric increase in AMT filers. And by the time this group reconvenes in 2005, the number of filers over a four-year period will have doubled. I think it's fair to say in another 4 years it will have doubled again, and then you're going to really have a problem. So what the intent here is, and I don't know if there's money available given our budget difficulty or what, is to try to remove as many people as possible from the AMT, particularly those in the upper middle class area who, because of the non-indexing of the personal exemption, but personal or standard deduction, have found themselves paying this extra tax. And I would suspect that Nina can also do a tax incidence study of showing who would be thrown off of the AMT if 2643 were adopted. The reviser note that is in here is very similar, except that it also has a uses another pressure point, which is the home mortgage interest deduction. And what it does is it allows $5,000 worth of mortgage interest to be deducted for purposes of the AMT. And again, you know, to me that adds a little bit of complexity. On the other hand, it may be a way in which to get the folks out who aren't making a lot of money, or who aren't at the higher ends making a lot of money, to get them off of the AMT and to try to get back more to the intent. We do have three witnesses. The reviser note that's in here was a file that was just sent over late last week by Senator Ress, so it's not exactly a cabal over at One Carlson Place, the epicenter of the Taxpayers League. We do have three testifiers who've signed up in advance. Chris Sullivan, could you come forward at this time, Chris? Welcome to the committee, Mr. Sullivan. Please identify yourself for the tape.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Chris Sullivan, and I'm the Director of Information Systems at the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits. We're a statewide association of about 1,400 charities in the state. We're grateful for the chair's continued leadership on this issue and the legislature's willingness to address this proposal to fully restore the tax incentives for charitable giving for those people who are subject to the alternative minimum tax. I was here during the special session a year and a half ago, 2002, asking to have it restored in any capacity, and now we're grateful that we're almost at the point where we can restore it fully. Phasing out the 1% exclusion will have a positive impact on charitable giving. Those who pay the alternative minimum tax are among our most generous philanthropists, and their contributions to society make a real difference in the state of our state. While they often give because they're dedicated to contributing to the community, how much they give is often shaped by tax incentives. Those incentives are still needed. For nonprofit organizations and the people and communities they serve, it is essential to continue the progress that was begun during the special session of 2002. So we ask you to pass the bill, particularly the section regarding the phase-out of the charitable contributions. And I'm available for questions.
Any questions for Mr. Sullivan? Thank you.
Thank you.
Now we get into the accountants. It's that time of the year. Todd Koch and Ruth Ann McNay. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Koch and Ms. McNay. Please identify yourself at the table.
Thank you, Chairman Abrams. My name is Todd Koch, K-O-C-H. I'm a partner with the accounting firm John A. Knutson & Company. I'm also a member of the Minnesota Society of CPAs.
I am Ruth Ann McNay. That's M-I-C-H-N-A-Y. I'm a tax manager at Troy & Associates, a law firm in St. Paul, and I, too, am representing the Minnesota CPA Society.
Please proceed.
I appreciate this opportunity to address an area that my children don't understand is near and dear to my heart. And what we have is a situation here where the federal alternative minimum tax is a bad situation. Unfortunately, there's the Minnesota situation makes things even worse when you're explaining things to clients. What we've had is a situation where, since, as described by Mr. Michaels, that if we had indexed the initial exemption, we'd be up to almost $80,000 today. In other words, our exemption would have doubled. In a situation, the current home mortgage interest deduction, if you look at what housing costs have done since 1982 to 2003, they've almost tripled. The value of a personal exemption has gone from $1,000 to over $3,000 in this period of time. Unfortunately, that means that this exemption amount that was meant to capture the people that are taking too large of advantage of loopholes in the tax code is being absorbed by a lot of personal exemptions and home mortgage interest and just changing another lifestyle. That really wasn't the intent of this body, I don't believe, back when it was passed in the early 80s. It's just evolved into this type of an issue. We appreciate that you're starting to address the issue now, because if you look at the number of taxpayers that are expected to pay the AMT, yes, the federal balloon is worse than the Minnesota balloon as a percentage, but if you look at what would be projected, we'd be almost tripling the number from 2001 to 2007, and that's a very grave concern. We appreciate you addressing the issue when it's a $33 million problem rather than when it's a $100 million problem, and it may become even to the point of not being able to be addressed and taken care of.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much, Representative Abram, for introducing this bill. The handout you have is just for your informational purposes. And recently, the Star Tribune had a number of articles in the last 2 weeks on the AMT. The federal alternative minimum tax is trouble with a capital T, and that stands for tax. It can become a double TT that stands for a terrible tax. We do not want it to become the double T in Minnesota. The House files that you have take the T that rhymes with P and pulls out the devastating effect for the payer. We support raising the exemptions and indexing to inflation, phasing out the charitable limitations and the home mortgage interest deductions. The two examples I would like to share with you are a single mom with one child, a salary of $38,000, lives in Shoreview, paid no federal AMT. She paid $568 in Minnesota AMT. Another taxpayer who filed married filing separate with W-2 income of $25,300 lives in New Brighton. Two children she itemized with state taxes, real estate, mortgage interest, and charitable deductions. The result was a negative income with a zero federal tax. That negative tax flowed over onto the Minnesota tax return, and of course, state tax was added back on. And the various in the AMT tax calculation, she was taxed on $25,300. because the difference in their, then they subtracted the $20,000, that was the exemption amount, and so the tax was a tax of $336 on an income of $25,300. In Minnesota, we want to think of the P, the payer, and not the T for tax. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any questions? Representative Mullery.
Mr. Chairman, do we have here an industry coming in that's asking to give them less work?
Well, Representative Mullery, let me explain this for Mr. Pope and Ms. McNay. Somebody will come to their office and drop off their taxes, the material necessary to prepare their tax return. And they will prepare it. And then the client comes back to the office to go over the return and have any questions answered. And what they have to do, if somebody fits under either the state or the federal AMT, is they have to explain it to their client. And the client understands that they have to pay tax and thinks that if there's an alternative minimum tax, that's something that Red McCombs ought to pay, not some single woman in Shorewood making $28,000 a year. And clients, for whatever reason, take it out on the accountant who tells them about it. And one of the other phenomena
like
you see is that they may not see that client again if they're really teed off. They will go shopping to the people who offer refund anticipation loans. They'll be watching infomercials at 2:30 in the morning on the Lifetime channel of some guy out of Dodge City, Kansas, about how you can save money on your taxes. And then you're going to have somebody who is going to basically be on the fringes of the system. So are they coming and asking for less work? No, I think they're coming and asking to clarify what their job is and make it a little bit easier for the client to understand. Representative Burrell.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I just have a comment, not really a question, but we adopted tax policy on the federal level to give tax preferences to exclusions, deductions, and credits. And then we turn around and say, well, because wealthy people are actually using these exclusions, deductions, and credits, we have to punish them. And I think it was gutless on the part of the federal government to implement the alternative minimum tax. And I think we should actually look at repealing it, not just toying around with it to try to accommodate the federal government. So I just wanted that point to be made that it's a terrible policy. If the deductions, exclusions, and credits are not right, let's deal with those. That's what a tax committee should do. And let's not play with the political bombshell that the federal government has left us in this alternative minimum tax.
Representative Burrell, I agree with you. If you take a look at the tax code, federal tax code, when this is enacted in 1969, it was because of a high rate, high deduction situation possible for people with substantial incomes. And Joel, I think I caught you on the one time you're wrong during the year. I think it was the $200,000 a year person. That was, I think there were 217 of them that the federal government was originally trying to get. If you have a good system with the types of deductions in place, you shouldn't need an alternative minimum tax. And I would personally be surprised if somebody who would be thought of as wealthy under the Minnesota income tax system with the deductions available would be totally able to avoid taxes. I may be wrong, and Nina can probably run the numbers and have a pretty good idea about the deductions under the HIP simulation. But I don't think you would find many of the $500,000 a year taxpayers having enough deductions in order to completely walk in Minnesota. Federal government is a little bit more dicey because they have a few more preferences. But at least as far as the Minnesota income tax, I think it's pretty, and we have two accountants up there. I think it's pretty difficult for somebody to be thought of as wealthy, somebody with a mid six-figure income, to completely walk with the deduction, particularly when we don't allow the deduction to federal income tax paid. I don't think it's very easy for somebody to walk.
Yeah. Oh. Mr. Chair, yeah, you're correct. It's very I can think of no taxpayers in my practice that would fit in that group. Unfortunately, we've come to a situation with the Minnesota AMT where the average taxpayer that pays AMT in our office pays less than $5,000 in Minnesota income taxes. It's what they're getting hit by is the primarily the difference in charitable contributions and the lack of a home mortgage interest deduction. So that is what's creating it. And if you look at the one of the other charts in your materials, we talk about the number of taxpayers on the chart you see up here. But if you look at the revenues collected, you'll see that the revenues collected have risen slower than the number of taxpayers impacted. So that in 1985, we had an average of $4,000 of AMT collected per taxpayer. If you project out the numbers, it's less than $1,000 on average per taxpayer in 2007. So what we're doing is we're putting a larger compliance burden. And to directly address the representative question, I would love to put less time into calculating all this AMT stuff, because as Mr. Abrams stated, it is not a pleasant conversation to explain to somebody, what do you mean I can't deduct my home mortgage interest, so now I owe another $1,000? Obviously, it's my fault when they walk into my office, and that's really lovely to deal with on about April 13th. But I do my best to educate my taxpayers, and I explain to them that's correct, and where they can find out how to contact those people, because it is very important that we have a tax system that's understandable and is dealing with good tax policy. The best way I can explain it is, I would explain to my wife's uncle. He called regarding his taxes in California. Yes, it's one of the few times I hear from him. And he calls in, and he's explained to his tax situation. And he looked like he was a candidate for paying the federal alternative minimum tax due to a situation he had. And he said, I said, you should look at this and fill out the form. He said, oh, Todd, is it going to help? No, it's not going to help. It will only increase your tax. Why should I fill it out then? We want taxpayers to understand what they're doing, and they will pay. Most taxpayers, they want their taxes as low as possible, but when you explain it, they don't mind paying an understandable tax.
Federal tax certainly isn't understandable. Now, let me get this straight under federal AMT. If somebody were to purchase a second home, they are far better off either refinancing or kicking off a mortgage on their principal residence rather than on the second home, because it doesn't count against the AMT. Did I get it wrong? If you're going to buy a second home, aren't you better off kicking the equity out of the first home and using the cash to purchase the second home under the federal AMT?
Mr. Chairman, no. The federal alternative minimum tax only allows acquisition and improvement indebtedness to qualify for the home mortgage interest deduction. So it really doesn't matter which home secures it. It's a question of how you use the proceeds.
Representative Mallory.
Oh, Mr. Chairman, I was just going to point out that everybody took my question seriously. It was intended as levity. Lawyers come in all of the time to clear things up, which takes away their money, but glad to see others doing
it. Any further discussion? Representative Lincheski.
I did introduce a bill to abolish the Minnesota AMT very late, and in fact, Ms. Manzi was kind enough to send me an email saying if you hurry up and try to get on the calendar here, we could possibly get a fiscal note, and I didn't do that because I was working on single sales. But I think Mr. Michael has some information. The reason I did that was to see what it costs. If you just got rid of it, and maybe Mr. Michael can tell us what that is.
Mr. Michael, getting rid of the federal AMT.
I believe it was cost prohibitive, but education.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think if you members just look at the table on page 3 of our handout, you would see what the cost would be of the sort of a baseline cost of the total repeal. Now, there's another element that's going on here, and that's that there's a credit in any year in which you pay AMT that's based on timing preferences, such as depreciation slash cost recovery allowances. You're allowed to carry forward that AMT that's attributable to those timing differences and reduce your regular tax in a later year down to the level of the AMT. And so if we repeal the AMT just outright, I think taxpayers who have those carry forward AMT credits would feel that it was not fair if you repealed that credit as well, and they'd probably want to allow them a period of time to claim that to reduce their regular tax. And so that would be an add-on that would increase the cost of a repeal bill above these numbers that are on Table 3 by a modest amount. But that basically Table 3 sort of gives you an idea of what the ballpark estimate would be on the cost of repeal.
And these are tax years rather than fiscal years, so the first year costs you 1.5 times. No, it doesn't mean a house of work.
Mr. Chairman, the AMT is generally assumed to fall primarily in January through April of the calendar year following the tax year.
Okay.
So a tax year will fall into the next fiscal year.
Okay. I'm not even going to go there. It's a good thing that you have Representative Atkins and Representative Sieben replacing Representative Dilbert, because I can just hear what he's going to say. I think it has something ring him up again. Any further questions? If not, the chair will lay over House File 2643 for further consideration, possible inclusion, omnibus tax bill.